Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Live your life like your own vacation. Well, thank you, Paul Stanley, for that advice. It's what I've been doing since I was knee-high to a grasshopper. Well, listen to that modern cultural reference. I sound like a 1950s dad. Welcome to Agitators Anonymous podcast. I'm Alan Averill. You may have noticed that I missed a week last week. That's because I was taking the advice from Paul Stanley of KISS, which was to live your life like your own vacation and just took the Friday off. Come on, come on, give me a break. As we edge towards episode 200, this is a special one and it's going to be a bit longer to make up for how much you missed me last Friday. And this is a conversation with my very good friend, comedian Steve Hughes. The video of it, which everyone wants to see, because if they want to see, well, look, Steve's infectious laugh and all that kind of thing. This will be out on Steve's channel. He has a new channel called Seriously Funny, which is great. He's starting to do proper interviews. And this is actually him interviewing me, more or less, sort of, not really. We start off and talk about death metal, his early work in Slaughterlord, Mortal Sin. There's stuff about comedy. There's woke culture. There's politics. There's all sorts of stuff in there. I was going to cut it into two because it's quite long. But you know what? As I said, seeing as you missed me all so much last week, let's put the whole bloody thing up there. Steve Hughes. Yes, indeed. Obviously, comedian Steve Hughes. If you don't know who I'm talking about, you can go and find so many huge clips of him online. I mean, there's clips on of his online on YouTube that have gone viral and have millions of views. Just put in Steve Hughes, you'll find them. And yes, he played the drums for Primordial back in 2002, 2003 for a tour Simon couldn't do with Rotting Christ. And he used to live in my house, which we also discuss in the podcast. It's a welcome return for the guy. I know him for a quarter of a century, 25 years, I think. But before we get there, let's just say this. If you want to follow me on Instagram, nemthianga_primordial, or you want to follow Primordial, we're still trying to build up the channel over there. Go to Primordial_official, and we're going to be trying to raise our game content-wise over there, whatever that means. We will be playing at Ragnarok Festival in Germany. I guess the biggest pagan metal, whatever you want to call it, festival in Lichtenfels. Maybe the third or fourth time we've done that. Really looking forward to that. I realise that I don't often discuss the gigs or the things that are coming up or this or that. I'm also a booking agent over at Dragon Productions. You can find a link underneath. I'm going to start putting that link in there. Recently, I book a few bands, everything from Virgin Steel all the way to Morning Beloveth, Mistherming to Gehenna, and now Saturnalia Temple, amongst other things. So if you're out there and you're doing a small fest and you're thinking, God damn it, I need Saturnalia Temple, well, look, follow the links underneath and you'll find your way to the Dragon Productions site. Also, I realise I never really mention these things. The show, as ever, is sponsored by Metal Blade Records, and you can go to indiemerch.com. Metal Blade Records, use the promo code AA2024 and get 10% off your order, because we are coming to the US in May for Maryland Death Fest, and then we're going to play five gigs afterwards, I think, four or five, with Bloodbath, Archgoat, and Severe Torture. I better have my death metal voice polished and ready and prepared so I can replace all the vocals. No, not really. It's going to be the first time, I think, in over 10 years we play club shows in the United States. So really looking forward to that one. It's going to be very interesting and very cool, we hope, indeed. So let's get into this. This is me and Steve talking. Like I said, it's for his channel, Seriously Funny, but I'm allowed to put out the audio on my podcast, which you are listening to. Like I said, all over the place, random chat, which starts all about death metal and all that kind of thing, which is incredible, really, because when you think about it, Slaughter Lord's demo, Dabba Power, is 86. And, like, they are one of the first ever blast beat bands. Slaughter Lord, you know, that die by power, da 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 da. This has got to be one of the first proper, you know, blast beats out there. So he's an OG when it comes to that death metal scene. And so let's start off and hear what Steve Hughes has to think about the fact that Hellhammer Apocalyptic Raids could be the first ever death metal record ever released. All right, let's get into it, my friends. Agitators Anonymous.
Do you think Apocalyptic Raids is the first ever death metal record? 1984, it's before Seven Churches. Is it death metal?
Well, I don't consider it possessed death metal.
But it has a song on the album called Death Metal.
But also, didn't Hellhammer or Celtic Frost, one of them, come out in that noise compilation called Death Metal before that?
Yeah, and so did, but they were Running Wild were also on that.
See, it depends whether or not people see death metal as a musical style or just because they had the songs. Because I'd consider Scream Bloody Gore the first one, because they're the two that battle it out, aren't they?
Well, Scream Bloody Gore is 87, Seven Churches is 85, but
right. 80.
I liked your Def Leppard reference off the top. How are you? Your new podcast channel. Well, here we go. We must have met 25 years ago, actually.
1999, man.
Wow. And all because of, pretty much because of a t-shirt kind of thing. You were in Brussels, which was the rock bar in Dublin at the time, and you'd come over to do comedy, and you were staying in Ballinasloe or something, wasn't it?
With Connor.
Yeah. But, like, which is, okay, now, that's a very Irish thing to do, is to drop names into a story that nobody else who has any concept of is going to understand the name of.
I was thinking that exactly. If you want to know who Connor is, folks, Connor is the young Irish chap I met in Australia who I moved to Ireland with.
Yeah, but no, but the point is, like, you'd come over to Europe to do some comedy, but you were living in Ballinasloe, which is the equivalent of, like, I suppose, being in, like, Wyala from Melbourne or something like this. Yeah. I picked Wyala for a reason.
Yeah, I know why.
And then we met you in Brussels, me and my mate, and then you told us, I used to be in Slaughter Lord, and we were like, hang on, wait, what? Stop, hang on. Pull the digger, pull the stopper, or whatever. Wait, what? And that was a sort of like, really fucking Slaughter Lord? And then, as they say, a beautiful and less beautiful friendship evolved from that moment. But you were, I think you came back to a session in our house that night, and I think, what, like 2 weeks later, we're living on our couch somehow.
I lived on that couch for like 9 months. So what the heavy metal world doesn't know is that I used to sleep on the couch while Alan was playing video soccer till 4 in the morning. And I'd be lying behind him like this, trying to get to sleep while Paul Kearns was upstairs. Remember he used to put eggs in a cup in the microwave?
But he wasn't doing that. He might have been doing that for more. Yeah, we lived in a kind of a DOS house, really. We had a sort of heavy metal DOS house. I mean, like Simon lived there. Simon, he used to be in Destroyer 66 for a while. He lived in that house. And like sometimes you'd come down on a Sunday morning and there'd be like 10 people asleep all around the floor and whatever. And like we literally, well, that was the old sort of heavy metal way though, wasn't it? You sort of met someone, went, hang on, you used to write to that person, you used to write to this person. Or you're wearing a shirt. Like I talked to Simon from Destroyer because he's wearing a Sodom shirt, in 1999, which is really unusual. It's like, fucking Sodom. He goes, yeah, mate, fucking Sodom. And like,
wearing, and swearing. We've been disturbing YouTube's community guidelines, folks.
They won't notice it because it was F-A-C-K, not
yeah.
Different spelling. Well, yeah, but that was it, though. I mean, you would write a letter to somebody, or you'd meet somebody who knew somebody who's somebody, and all of a sudden, well, then you had to extend this sort of Masonic handshake of, right, you're living on our couch now. But we,
that's the scene that old metalheads miss when it was outsiders. It was underground, and you just saw a guy in a Metallica shirt or a Maiden shirt, and you went like that from across the street, and they went like that, and you went, And there was a bond, you know, and that's what's funny about the new metalheads when they go, how can these old guys, go on about this carry on? Because you don't know what you're missing.
Yeah.
You don't know what you're missing. And when Korn turned up with tracksuit pants and dreadlocks, it was all like, well, see.
Hey, don't knock tracksuit pants. But yeah, no, I know what you mean. But I think it's more like that we're one of the last generations generations in and around, I suppose, mid-40s on, who will have grown up before the internet, who would have been teenagers before the internet. And so obviously back then, I mean, I'm a little bit younger than you, but everybody just wrote letters to each other. But there was that sort of thing. But the first time we ever toured in America or toured across Europe, even in the late 90s and stuff, you'd meet somebody who'd go, I'm such and such, who wrote you a letter in 93. You're staying in my house tonight, kind of thing. You know what I mean? And you would continue that sort of pen pal friendship, because that's what the old underground was kind of about. But it seems to be, it's not just heavy metal. I'd say that's kind of non-existent in such an atomized digital world that you don't really get that sense of that kind of same thing anymore.
No, you don't get it.
I think so.
That's what I used to call tape trading, the internet before the internet, done by stamps and envelopes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it opened up Australia to having access to the world, because if we were in Slaughter Lord like we were in 85, 86, and we'd sent the demo made in a guy's garage to Kerrang, they would have thrown it in the bin. But once I could write to some guy called, you know, in Cuba or Portugal or Sweden or somewhere, then it all opened up. I mean, the first fanzine I ever was in was Violent Noise by that Borov, whose name I could never say.
Yeah, yeah. Borovosh.
Who was, you know, dealing with Sepultura, bringing Sepultura all up to the States. And so, you know, it was all connected like this. That's how I ended up, you know, knowing Metallion, who's famous in the black metal world, folks, who put out Slayer Mag.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was legendary. It was just a brilliant time, which brings me, because I listened to your, going back to old school stuff, I listened to your review of the new Metallica record. Which I thought was a great review. In fact, you should be a record reviewer. You're really good at it. And it was spot on. In fact, I agreed with you on everything. The old albums, I mean, and I even went back and listened to Kill 'Em All this morning, because the drum sound is excellent. I remember that drum sound, the toms, the snare, and Kirk Hammett's leads are just blistering.
Yeah.
They're blistering on those first three records. And I'm like you, I don't hate the Black Album. I was like, yeah, well, you know, it seems like a normal progression from Master of Puppets to me. That and Justice for All's that big mess in the middle, you know.
Mess, yeah.
Yeah. And then but yeah, you're right. Like I've given load and reload re-listens over the years to go, okay, have I just missed? I liked Until It Sleeps. I thought it was an all right song.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I just and then I loved your description of St. Anger. It made me laugh. The album they had to do cathartically, but no one needed to hear.
Oh, it's just a therapy record, you know?
Yeah, a therapy record.
It's like as if all of a sudden, remember, if we were up some night at 5 a.m. and I had to sit there and watch you pace up and down in the front room, and I went, wait a second, can we put it out as a podcast? Keep neurosis.
Steve's having a crisis of self-confidence. Let's film it and put it out.
Straight away, Steve's undercooked neuroses press it into a 7-inch the next day. Yeah. I mean, or, you know, eat a piece of undercooked. Yeah, I mean, that's what it was. But, like, I think that old bands are, there seems to be a habit now amongst old bands, whether it's Candlemass or Destruction or Creator or whatever, that they do find their way, in a way, back to the beginning.
Yeah.
Because they get lost in the middle somewhere. And I remember having a conversation with Millet from Creator, and he was like, basically what he said is, like, this is all I've known since I was 15. We went from selling 300,000 records to like 30, 40 with Endorama. What do I do? Do you quit? Do you give up? You've never had a job, maybe, you know, properly. What the fuck do I do? And we as metalheads, we take ownership of a logo, ownership of a band, ownership of things. And then when we forget the fact that maybe until you're a little bit older, you go, okay, maybe he was 43 and hadn't a fucking clue what to do. You can let them step out from the timeline and you can step in afterwards, you know, and go, all right, we're now reacquainted again. So maybe you don't have to have St. Anger in your collection, but then you pick up the new one. And when I heard the new one, I was like, okay, I hate the drum sound. I hate the tones, But you know what? It's got a little bit of No Life to Leather, a little bit of No Remorse in some of the songs. And I thought, all right. So they found some of that old spark. Now, of course, nothing will ever be like it was, but
no,
you know.
But you're right. You know, it's because, I mean, they've got a few load. What's funny is when Death Magnetic is a nothing to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Sometimes it would kick in. There was a riff that would kick in. You go, okay, we've got it here. And then for some reason, it goes off into some Deep Purple territory. Why am I over here with this riff now? What's And as you said, exactly, I can't remember a thing off it.
No, right, can't remember a lyric, a line, or nothing, or whatever. But they, well, that's because Hetfield lost his way, didn't he? He sort of went to, I have a friend of mine loves Some Kind of Monster. And I said, well, as a piece of cinema, I get why you like it because it's engaging and it has Jeopardy. But like as a Metallica fan, that was everything that we loved them for being, which was tough as nails, deconstructed right before our eyes. And you went, oh, here's my hero for when I'm 16. And here they are crying at the kitchen table about, like, to a therapist who's paying them 30 grand a month. And you want to go, stop being such weak. See you next Tuesdays, you know, but
and the choice of therapist.
And he's writing lyrics.
You couldn't have got a more metal therapist. I mean, really.
Think about this. He might have got. I need to check. Maybe he has some lyric writing credits. If he has a credit for writing those lyrics, he's getting a residual on the publishing.
Anyway, it's like, I mean, with the creator stuff, I can add. Sorry, mate.
Let's not talk about lost publishing.
Yeah. I mean, with the old creator stuff going into renewal, which was, I understand back then because, you know, metal wasn't so atomized into categories. And so, especially when it was extreme. So, you know, you got Tom Warrior here, but you had Merciful Fate, but you had Voivod, but you had, you know, and then punk was kind of crossing over. And so it was kind of all outlier music. And the idea of experimentation was quite ripe then, you know, because it wasn't, oh, it's a death metal, thrash metal, this metal, that metal. It was kind of, it was just a breakaway from the old traditional metal.
Yeah.
And so, and I knew that he was very inspired by Voivod, you know, Mil Petroza, and he probably liked the idea of it. Let's do a weird and also what you had industrial coming into it.
I like that when your modern reference for creator changing is 32 years old.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like
yeah.
Renewal could have worked, but the production
I liked it. But
oh no, I didn't like it.
Killing Joke and there's a bit of Helmet in there, but I think it's a good record. But anyway,
it's the production. It's too harsh. It's like Terrible Certainty. I can't get into it.
Oh, I love it.
No. Stopping with Menace. I can't. It's really low on my. And then what happened after renewals? Ventors left. So like in any band that's got a big career, they've got their dodgy era.
Yeah.
So at least Mil Petroza is strong enough to keep the whole thing going. Rob Ferretti's left. Ventors left. He pulls in these guys. He's on a subsection of Noise Records called Gun or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it comes out, and it's just not that good. And then he tried to do, the Endorama, which if you – doesn't offend me. I don't think it's a sellout, but it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work.
It offended you in the front room one time when we had an argument about it, probably in 1999.
What, Steve Hughes got offended? He's not allowed to get offended. He's the not offended comedian guy.
But I think I deigned to like turn off Rush or something at like 3 in the morning in 1999.
Yeah. At least you ended up liking them. Yeah. So
this is true.
And yeah. So the funny thing is with Creator is then they get back on board. What with it? They do Outcast, which is and it's got some of their tracks they still play live, like Phobia and stuff like this. But it's got they get back on with Violent Revolution.
Ah, there you go.
And I respect Creator no end. I mean, they were my favorite band back in Slaughterlord days. But what I think, and so the new stuff, I used to listen to it when it started with what, after Violent Revolution, you've got kind of what?
Hordes of Chaos.
Hordes of Chaos is the next one, right? And then it's where that Finnish chap comes in.
Oh, yeah.
And he doesn't bang
the head that doesn't bang, does he?
What he does is, I guess Mil Petroza wanted it. He adds that melodic element, but yeah. he puts flowery themes, as I would call them, like Kirk Hammett used to put a sort of thing over the top, like in Ride the Lightning days, and he puts them over the top, but they're but they're flowery. I can understand they're trying to combine this brutality with this melody, but sometimes I'd be going, it's weakening the power with this with this flowery thing, and I'm just like, be a bit tougher, you know. It's like the new record. I mean, I got to respect him. I love him. Ventor's what, 55? He's still bashing the drums like a maniac, and Mil Petros is still, they're still going hard. So I respect him for forever and ever. And I like some of the new album, but the last track, Dying Planet, on the new one, that's probably the best one on it. It even sounds like Burzum sometimes. That's when he puts like there's a Burzum-y theme over the. And I go, yeah, put more of that, not this flowery power metal stuff.
I wonder, was that the you know the way when you're writing songs, before you've worked out the title, you have like pet names for them. Wonder that written on the whiteboard, Burzum theme. We've got to change that.
Anyway, let's instead of us, me and you just having a old school chat while people like, look at these two wankers going on for hours. I like to ask all the fans, so let's go back so they know a bit about you. When did you get into metal? Like obviously we all like music before metal, I assume, as kids, you know, you'd be. And then so what you didn't?
No
ABBA for you?
No, I'm actually I got into like my sort of musical consciousness seemed to come online somewhere about 1983, and that was ZZ Top Eliminator. My dad used to play it around the house, and he was listening to, you know, he liked, you know, Lightning Hopkins and John Lee Hooker and stuff. And I started to become aware of blues, but then very quickly ZZ Top Eliminator. Then my uncle gave me a whole bunch of records somewhere around about 84, 85, maybe it was 8, 9 or 10, which was UFO, Strange of the Night, compilations with Maiden, with Sabbath, with Deep Purple, with Argent, with you know, Scorpions and stuff. And by 86, I was into Maiden and Priest, then Megadeth, then Slayer, so Venom, Dark Angel. Then by 88, I was tape trading, and 87, Scream Bloody Gore. I was only like 12, 13, 14. So by 88, Pestilence, Bathory, Death. So I never had a...
You're like Lewis, the guy I spoke to like the other day.
Remember buying Understand the Black Mark on cassette in the end of 87. I never liked pop music. I never had any like, you know, a summer where I listened to what you could, you know, anything that wasn't heavy rock or pop music. I just literally went ZZ Top, Sabbath, Scorpions, Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, Slayer, Death, Morbid Angel, Demos, Thy Kingdom Come, by end of 88. And I was just only talking to my friend before this, and I said, like, whatever's happened to me, like, my listening tastes now are almost exactly the same as 1991. She was telling me about some Joni Mitchell album. I said, look, I with all due respect to Joni Mitchell, I don't give a fuck. I mainly listen to Infernal War. I just don't give a shit. All I listen to is all I listen to is extreme, brutal, violent, either that or Dronescape, dark stuff, or maybe Townes Van Zandt, or early 80s goth sort of post-wave. But I have no time for anything with any subtlety at all anymore. Lockdown
really
crashed the hole in my brain. All I listened to was just super brutal death metal, Ulcerate, whatever. I just couldn't get creepy.
I noticed last time when I was with you in Ireland, I came into your house and you were listening to Sargophago at 5 in the afternoon.
Yeah. My listening tastes are pretty much, they've gone back to where they were in 88 to 92. Like, you know, somebody said to me, oh, you know, do you still have Tori Amos' Little Earthquakes on something? I went, no, forget it. Like, just even a concept.
Right, yeah.
Maybe. But like, I would have given that a moment. It just came into my head. I would have given that a moment in 92 where I'd have gone, oh, an open-minded moment. I'm so closed-minded now. I just don't give a fuck. All I listen to is just super brutal all the time. Or like I said,
What about old trad metal?
Yeah. Yes, but less so. Maybe it's because of, I think what happened is that during lockdown, I was so angry and so off the dial into deep dark water. And the only thing that I could listen to was just or like, I got really into like really strange Dronescape sound stuff. But again, anything with any hope in it, we hate hope.
That's what Henry Rollins used to say. I'm not into hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like that's what happened. And then like what happened is that my first school band was maybe end of 88. We were called Cranial Slaughter. And we've never made a demo. We were just a bunch of kids messing around. Then I tried to play the bass and sing, and me and my friends did some like I think Discharge and GBH covers in the school in 89. Then I was in the Sound Cellar, the metal shop in Dublin, where we all used to go in the end of the 80s. And one day I saw an ad on the wall and it said Fingal-based death metal band. Fingal is where the guys from Primordial Are Scaries, looking for a singer. And I took down the number. And then about an hour later, somebody had put up a poster over it for some gig. And I rang up Paul, who's still the bass player and who you know. And I was the only person who rang up. And I went out. And of course, I was like... This is August the 29th, 1991. And I went, ah. But because I was wearing like a Rotting Cry shirt and had like super long hair, they just went, yeah, all right, you'll do. And that was...
Mate, that's the way.
Yeah, and that's Kieran, Paul and me, August 91, who are still the same three people. And then Simon joined in 96, 97. And that's sort of it. We were... They're playing together since November 87 when they were 12 and like 14, and they made some demos in 88, actually a death metal demo in 88, but they never released it. And that's kind of how it went. And then you starting a death metal band in Dublin in 1991. So, you know, your main impulse is sort of, we're underground kids writing letters and doing fanzines and stuff, is to try and find some way of making music to cope with the fucking state of the city and to cope with the state of the city in 91, you know, because the Dublin that you know now from visiting, of course, is a far cry from the Dublin of 1989 or 90 or 1991, which was a pretty...
But it's a far cry from the Dublin of 1999 when I moved there.
Yeah, or even 2009. Yeah, that's how it all sort of started. So, I mean, I got into hard rock super early, 8, 9 years old. Like I said, by 11... was listening to, you know, Iron Maiden and Venom, and then by 13 was tape trading with writing to Pestilence.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so I went very early, very extreme, and then sort of and never changed pretty much.
Well, see, that's good because you had someone to give you records. At 11, 13, I didn't have, you know, 12 years old. I was like, I think my stepmother's parents who lived next door for a time would buy us a Beatles or ABBA record every fortnight to share amongst my brother. And we were in the Blue Mountains in the bush. I didn't hear any heavy metal.
What's that Spinal Tap quote? We're swimming in a sea of retarded sexuality.
So, okay, my next question in that sense, because I never even asked. Well, I never asked you this. Of all the years I've known you, why did you? Because, you know, I thought I'd wanted to play guitar first, but it was too hard for me to do this with my big, lanky fingers. So I thought I'll play drums. So what made you go, I'm going to sing?
Well, originally it wasn't. I mean, the first ever band I had when I was a little, like maybe 12, 13, we, like I said, we had two bands and we tried to rehearse and we tried to play Blitzkrieg Bop and Witching Hour by Venom, which is sort of the same song, actually. Fifth, seventh fret, open, whatever. And
Blitzkrieg Bop, Ramones, is it?
Yeah, that's the same song as Witching Hour by Venom. Same.
Oh, is it?
No. It's the same notes. Anyway, whatever. So we tried to play that. And I just was the de facto singer because I was even worse at everybody else than playing. And like I'm playing the bass for years and years and years, and I'm still pretty awful. But I just ended up being by sort of default the singer. And then when I answered the Primordial ad, the intention in 91 was that you're going to learn the guitar to be the rhythm guitar player singer. And then very quickly, it became very obvious that everybody else's expertise was well beyond my capability. You know, like if I was going to try and catch up. And then I just sort of, I mean, I can play the guitar a bit now and I can play the bass, but it became very obvious that like, if you're going to be a particular kind of front man, you're not a guitar playing front man. You have the freedom with your hands, you know, the David Coverdale Carl McCoy thing, and that just sort of appealed to me. And then I just fell away from being just a singer. So And then you are just the singer, even though you haven't the intention of adding. Like, I don't come into Pony and go, here, Kieran, here's my shit riff. Or whatever. You don't fix what's not broken.
And yeah, so yeah.
It became that thing. I just ended up becoming, you're just the singer. I don't know. It wasn't my intention. I don't know. Like, why? Like, did you mess about with the guitar before you picked the drums, or was it you just always wanted the drums?
No, I knew a guy. I knew these two guys, these two English guys. One of them was this kind of friend of my father's, the son of the friend of my father's. And the other guy was his next door neighbor, who was this sort of early gothy punk guy that used to have earrings when we were kids, and he had a weird hairdo, and he used to walk, and his arms didn't move. And so he's the guy that I used to hang around, and he's the guy that showed me all like post-punk and punk and Susie and the Banshees. And he was into sort of New Romantic that was hitting the world, Human League and all this, Ultravox. And we'd sit up and watch these music shows together and smoke cigarettes. And he hated metal. I never really heard of metal, but I knew he didn't like it. And then that's when I saw Run to the Hills and went, sook.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And then, great. I don't have to try and pretend to like half these jam songs I don't really like. So with those two guys, one of them started to play guitar, and he used to muck around on bass. And I thought maybe I could learn to play guitar. And I was like, you, I was just my talent. And then they went, well, just get a drum kit. And I went, all right.
Yeah.
And so I got a drum. So I was like you in the sense of I didn't get a drum kit and learn drums. I got a drum kit and joined a band with two other guys who couldn't play. And we sat there, like, not being able to play, right? So my whole intention was just to be in a band immediately. You know, that was why I got one. And then I just became obsessed, basically, like you.
It seems the drums are weirdly, right? They seem so, they're so primal, but yet there seems something really intellectually counterintuitive about it, in that to be a good drummer is, I think, to be even more complicated than being a good guitar player, because you're talking about the movement of, you know, both arms and both legs doing like totally different things, different rhythms, different whatever. The brain has to work a certain particular way to be really good at the drums. Whereas I'm a reasonable bass player and I'm not a good musician at all. But being good at the drums, but you pick it up in the beginning because it's just hitting things, where it has a very primal sense to it, but yet it's quite a very clever, intellectually minded thing.
That's a great observation, because that's why I could start it, because I could start it quick. Whereas trying to make my fingers go, now go like that, make the little one go. I was like,
because listen to it, League with Satan. And you can tell they've written the song because he doesn't know, well, what's that? Like that. That's going to be a really fast beat. Just go bonk, bonk, and you can hear him opening the hi-hat going in the beat. You can tell that's like, I can't play the drums, I'm just going to do this, you know. But it's always fascinating, because I sometimes watch a really good drummer and you go, you know, and they've got their fucking feet doing the totally different thing to this, and it's and counting at the same time.
Well, and I think also that's where I get my love of starting bands and not being able to play. Because when I started Slaughter with Mick was already a good guitarist, but that's where me and him used to clash, because he lacked the emotional import that I wanted, because it was, well, you can't do that because it's a rule. And I worked out that it was great to have a guy that knew how to get around the fretboard.
Yeah.
But then it's like when Endless Playing Creator came out, I could tell the guys that couldn't get into it because they didn't think it was good enough in the sense of music. But I was like, what are you talking about? The entire thing is on fire. Right. Yeah. And so to this day, I still like that, like that Tom Warrior we've got here, that the use of primal simplicity.
Yeah.
And an S. And if you can write a song with like two notes, I mean, some of my Turnham songs, you know, I can't play guitar. They're on one string and they've got three riffs and the whole thing, but it goes for 7 minutes and no one notices because I know how to do it. Yeah. You know, and I love that primal simplicity.
The first things that we first ended up drinking at a party back then was like listening to In the Sign of Evil. And that just has this incredible primal energy to it, you know.
Mate, that's still my favorite Sodom record.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me too. With a great drum sound, and people go, oh, I don't like the
drum. That's maybe their best drum sound ever.
Totally. And it's like the snare on Endless Pain. The snare on Endless Pain is just power packed, right?
Sepulchral Voice has a better, the drum sound is better than Persecution Mania on that record.
Oh, much better. Yeah. 10 times better.
But it is interesting, though, because...
hang on. This is very interesting. This is what I love, too, because you are now known as one of the, you know, every comment section. I've been going through your albums and, like, every comment section, and you're known for the, you know, the passionate singing, the epic singing. You're known as one of the greatest singers in heavy metal now. And I love that, the fact that you came from guys who went, well, I can't play guitar, so I better do this, right? That's what I love about the underground, you know. I'll just do that because I can't do that. Now you're known for one of the, you know, and I know you're Irish, so you're gonna be hard to take a compliment, but it's like you are, you know. You read the comments. I mean, still, you listen to Coffin Ships, which is the track, folks, probably the fourth or fifth track off your fifth album, is it?
Gathering Wilderness, yeah.
Gathering Wilderness. Which is another area I want to go into, because I met you around, you were doing Spirit, the Earth of Flame.
Yeah.
So that's the third album, which I still think, and then you did Storm Before Calm, which is the third kind one. Of...
Maybe that's the transitional record with the shitty cover.
That's what I was going to say. It's what I wrote down here. Storm, the Spirit, the Earth of Flame. What have you got before that? Journey's End and Imrana.
Yeah, Jeremy's Enigma and an EP called The Burning Season.
Burning Season, which we played some of those tracks on the tour.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I still love, you know, The Soul Will Sleep on Spirit, The Earth of Flame, one of my favorite songs to play, and Gods of the Godless, which is still live in your set.
Yeah, we still do that, too.
And so, yeah, then you do have that is like this transitional album because the change into Gathering Wilderness, that's to me, that's like now Primordial's turned into Primordial on the Gathering Wilderness.
Yeah.
The change is so monumentally like bang. It's like the soul of Primordial's been born on that record. Like it's just matured into this bang. Here it is. Here it is.
I think the thing with excuse me. Cut that out. I think the thing is that when you're going to be the singer or the voice or whatever, I think you need to be a couple of different things at the same time. And that, you know, the technical stuff never really interested me that much, although I would like to be considered a reasonable singer or a good singer. But that wasn't that the most important thing. I think the most important thing for me was always to be able to impart the meaning and the diction and the whatever, right straight to the heart of the matter. Even if you could speak English or not, you understood, you know, I am, you know, where is the fighting man? I am he. The glory of a huge chorus, in the sense that you can be part hooligan, part poet, part rabble rouser, part, you know, you need to be a whole bunch of different things. You can be intellectual if you want.
That's a great description.
People can scrape the surface with it, but you also need to be a fucking hooligan. Oh, sorry. You also need to be, you know, if you're going to be live and heavy metal, like, come on, let's go. You need to be part primal. And so it's all those things. So, that's the beauty about old heavy metal, which we've talked about to death to the long hours, is that if you take the first Wasp album, which is, you know, I want to be somebody too. And you go, has a gonzoid beauty. That's like those old, you know, William Burroughs or something. Like it's such an explicit way of saying, I'm going to try and make my way to the top. And all those, the beauty about all those old heavy metal bands we love is they never second guess themselves. They're like, we're going to do this. And so you need to capture that. So that means you have to be in the bubble of understanding that, but also to be clever enough to step outside a moment and go, that's why it's beautiful. That's why Wasp is beautiful. And if you're too clever or you're too conceited, you'll never understand the primal beauty of sepulchral voice. You know what I mean?
Because what you talk about Wasp is I Want to Be Somebody, and I was just doing, because I've been listening to old Manowar lately, right? I've gone back to the first four. And lots of people used to, you know, call them corny and laugh at them, you know, got a bunch of, if you don't know who Manowar folks is, they're the guys who invented Viking metal out of New York. You would have thought Scandinavians did it, but a bunch of muscle-bound, oiled-up New Yorkers did. Yeah. And when I first...
Perhaps.
And I didn't even think it was silly. I was 16. I saw him there with swords. I thought it was great because what you said exactly, it inspired me to go, you do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Right? You express yourself however you want. And when you had songs like Mountains on Sign of the Hammer.
There we go.
Which was an absolutely inspirational song, you know, like a man is a mountain. Greatness waits for those who try.
Yeah. Right?
And what else? What is the other song that is?
So many songs. That's the beauty of that old heavy metal. And it's, you pick Manowar, the beauty of battle hymns or something. is that it's almost, it's so relentless in its pursuit of single-mindedness. And that's what I like. It has an orthodoxy to it that is, like, to me, singularly very sort of beautiful in its way. It doesn't go, here's something that you might think it's funny, so therefore it'll appeal to your narcissistic modern age. Like, you go and watch some nonsense metal band now that are full of, you know, people go, oh, you go and see, well, I'm not going to name a name, but I think you can think of the names that I mean, a modern band, and go, oh, do you like Manowar? Is that not the same thing? And you go, no, because this is conceited. This is narcissistic, and this is selfish, and this is, you're in on an in-joke. Now, in 1981, 82, with heavy metal, whether it was Twisted Sister or Wasp, or specifically Wasp, let's pick them, you're not in on an in-joke. You're in on an actual, like a white-knuckle ride, like a raw adrenaline, you know, thing. And that's that beauty of that old heavy metal, is that it didn't exist in a world where, let's say, intellectual conceit was one of its main pursuits. And you have to be clever enough to step outside that to understand it, that the reason it was like that was because it was so singular. And that's what's lost on many people. I don't know if I explained that properly, but.
It's brilliant. It's like when you say you're in on an in-joke. It's like when I used to go, you know, when people outside of metal used to laugh at metal, I go, no, we can laugh at the aspects of metal that's stupid, but you can't, because you don't respect the parts of it that are brilliant, even though it looks a bit silly, right?
It's poetry and primacy, or like primitivism and, you know, potential or something, if you want, like this. And just to never second guess, to just go, bum. So with Primordial, my intention was always, if you wanted some clever metaphors or wanted some intellectuality about whatever the things I was singing about, you could find it, but never to dress it up too much, which is what I learned, to be able to go, you know what, where is the fighting man? You know, to make it so that in a room full of 5,000 people, when you say that, they go, oh, I got that. Same with Coffin Ships. You don't have to understand English to understand, oh, this is tragedy. This is, there's something tragic happening. And so that's, the Primordial straddles a couple of different, sort of monolithic in that sense. It sort of strafes a whole bunch of different things, in the sense that if somebody doesn't understand Primordial, doesn't have the lyrics or the imagery or whatever, it's fine. But you get the emotional impact and resonance, because it doesn't need to be in your language. And so to be able to figure out a way of getting that message across, but also being clever for the people who want the clever thing. And also to let the clever people know there's a beauty in the primacy of it as well. And so that's what I think about all the time. That makes it.
No, that's fantastic, because that's I'm glad I asked you that question. It's a brilliant description. And I was watching a bit of the the Primordial documentary again. I've seen that a few times, and I thought I'd catch up on a bit to get a bit of info. And it was really great. I've forgotten that bit, how smart Leary is talking about the drums.
Yeah, like a way, you know, back forward.
Yeah, and really adding the, you know, not just making it this, but adding the flams and the space and then moving it so it moves. And I thought, yeah, this is really, really cool. I forgot about that bit. I'm doing a bunch of drummers. I was thinking I might get him on.
Yeah, he'd do it. Did you count the amount of pints Kieran drinks in his interview? Lots of cuts. And so he's looking at the floor for a while, trying to read something on the floor. And it just looks like every time I finish answer a question, his pint goes, broop, like down to the end.
Well, Kieran loves doing interviews, doesn't he?
Yeah, he didn't stop me doing it on my own, but it's like he must have thunk like 14 pints or something in that afternoon. And they just keep going.
So let's have a look, because I want to go and do, after what you've got, Gathering Wilderness, then we go into what album?
Gathering Wilderness, then we have To the Nameless Dead, which is the big one.
So that's bang. Because as much as you've got into a major label sort of or a proper label like Gathering Wilderness, that's every song's like 9 minutes.
Yeah. Gathering
Wilderness. Bleak.
The Nameless Dead is a bit more a tight production, and it's one with much more hits. It wasn't intentional, but it just was.
It's got Rome Burns on it.
Yeah, it's got Empire Falls.
One of my favorite, you know. It's got Gallows, like Coffin Ships.
It's got Gallows Hymn. It's got Traitor's Gate. Nation this Earth. And that sort of moved us into being from on the third stage at 6 p.m. to the end of the second stage to the beginning of the first stage. And it sort of moved us in from the periphery, from the outside. And then we made Redemption, the white one, which I really like that one.
Is that Redemption at the Puritan's Hand? That's yeah, I knew you'd like that one. That one I found a little tough to get into at the start. Yeah. Like it's a ragged, abstract bash around the head kind of, hang on, this is a tough one.
Yeah, and it's kind of an album about faith and religion and maybe an album that I wrote before I was old enough to fully grasp a hold of it, you know. The idea that you have some sort of, you have a small bit of jealousy for people who have their religious faith, you know, because you don't have any. And it should be something you maybe get to when you're 50 or 55, maybe not 31 or whatever. But I think I was probably born old. So, you know, it was about time I wrote that one. And then you have Where Greater Men Have Fallen, which I really like that one a lot. Big,
mate, that track itself. That title track. That's a monster.
I've just skipped over about five albums then. Yeah, I mean, I think what it is that we were never caught in this cycle of making albums so that we didn't have to do one every year. We couldn't have done anyway. We weren't making a living from it. We weren't making money from the band. We never really did. So we weren't professional. So there was no manager going, hey, it's about time to get back in the studio. So sometimes it would take 2-3 years, sometimes take 4 years, sometimes take five. And, you know, because it was always sort of, you know, quality over quantity. Well, at least we would think so. And we're always like super harsh on ourselves, biggest critics. And so we would never let anything kind of go, well, I don't know about this bit. And we would drop whole things pretty quickly and easily. But, you know, at this is the kind of stage where we sort of had a very great handle on what the sound of Primordial was. And so, and then there's a moment where you're going to go, maybe you're as big as you're going to get. You're as big, it's not going to get any bigger because the band, the way the band is not really constructed for to get to that other level. Some people say to me, you never got to the level above the where you are. And you go, well, I'm not sure we were ever going to be able to. Not without relentless touring, which of course was maybe impossible, but it is what it is. And the fact that
it's real music. I mean, what did you say the other day? It related to me completely, you know, in that, which is one of the reasons we're not more popular is, you know, because it's real and the world is a dark place. And I think we align with that, expressing that. And no one wants to know that all the time, you know. It's a lot easier to just go and listen to fun fist in the air metal, I had that issue with comedy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember we had a conversation about it before, and you said, I went to see some comedy thing here, and you said, how was it? And I said, well, there was a woman with a yoga mat laughing. So no, it wasn't funny. Doesn't work.
No, it's. I mean, you choose a tighter path when you decide. I've got the heart.
Yeah,
These
things thrive in dark places. That's because they're. You need them with my understanding of comedy is that I liked my comedians fucked up or I liked it dark or whatever you want to say because that you needed it to be like that to deal with what comedy was designed to deal with. I mean, who wants? You know, like comfortable middle class comedy. Well, you know, it's the same with heavy metal in the sense that old heavy metal wasn't, but like Primordial for me was sort of this has to be relentlessly dark because that's the way our history is. And I continue to see Primordial as a continuation of Irish literary and musical tradition, which is steeped in sorrow and tragedy, but also, you know, epicness and, you know, might and resistance and all whatever. So that's how it has to be. If I got to 55, I used to say this when I was 25, and now that I'm 7 years away from 55. If I wasted my life singing about like fast cars and beers and whatever, I mean, you know, and somebody goes, well, what did you do? Yeah, it seems a bit empty.
I know what you mean.
At least you made a stand for something that meant something. And you never intended it to be the biggest thing or the thing that, you know, allowed you to buy a house or whatever, all these things. If that happened, you know, okay. Plenty of dark things became big throughout time. But the way the world was set up now in the last 20, 30 years, I mean, the idea that Primordial was going to be headlining big festivals and being paid, it was not going to work out like that. But you know what? We're on stage two at 8 p.m. All right. You know, and we made it through 30 years. But like, you know yourself, comedy works in dark places because it's the antidote to that. Because people need to laugh at it. At least that's how I see it. And so I think the music I gravitated towards was the same thing. But totally. I didn't need, I don't, I mean, comedy and music or light relief, I don't need that. You know, and that's a difference. People think when they hear like a joke, stupid band, let's pick it for the sake of purposes of the conversation, Ailstorm or something. They think, oh, that's the same as Wasp. You know, it's not. It's not the same as Wasp because there's a 40, 50 year gap of culture there where society's changed a lot, where one thing, you know, it's the honesty of intent or whatever you want to call it. And then, as I said, this, you're part of an in-joke. You know, you're going to get tons of Ailstorm fans in the comment section. the point is that I think that, you know, there's answers to these things in modern society gives us, but they, as you say, the refusal to deal with the nature of the world head on. I understand that because not everybody wants bad news all the time.
And I know. I understand it too. I understand sometimes light relief is needed. You know, sometimes you need to put on Seinfeld or Father Ted but you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, just to go, okay, well, you know, whatever, just take me away from the nothing, from the, I mean, mentioning Neurosis, as you just did. I mean, you can't, we saw Neurosis in Dublin that time, and they played for about 3 hours. By the time you got out of there, you're like battered around the head with psychic sonics, you know.
Videos of people just shoveling corpses into graves behind them.
Yeah, I know. It was just, I came out of there psychically and spiritually exhausted. Like, whew, it was like.
That's what you want, you know. Now, I understand not every day can be like that, but you make your division. If you want entertainment, fine. You like it. You want to be entertained. That's okay. But then I'm not sure it gives you the, you know, to then go and criticize something that's art, you know, let's say art and entertainment, you know, you can be entertaining without being an entertainer. And going to see a band who are artistic can also be entertaining, but they're not entertainers.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
So if you just like music that's superficially entertaining, that's okay. But you don't get to judge the new Neurosis album or whatever it is.
No.
You know, you don't. I'm sorry, we have to make some divisions in how these things go. And that's, people say, oh, isn't heavy metal a bit elitist sometimes? Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Like, totally. Just
folk metal scene or jazz or whatever. Or, you know, like country and western, like the new country, the stuff that's on that's huge. It's horrible. And if I say to somebody, well, I personally like Townes Van Zandt, and they go, yeah, who's Townes Van Zandt? I go, look, well, if that's the question, you know, we have an answer.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's.
I know. I mean, it all ties into what this PC stuff is, which is just taking all the, like me and Thomas Sheridan were discussing, you know, the shadow. You can't face the shadow or do anything that's, you know, in this polarity of light and dark. We've all got to go over to the light now and pretend that everything's just shiny. That, but it's so robotic and fake. It's so dangerous to me. Like it's why. That's why I got into the PC comedy, attacking PC early, because I couldn't work out how anyone couldn't. Excuse, when a bunch of people turned up in the 2000s going, oh, we're going to maybe be able to arrest you if you upset someone. I'm like, didn't, how come now everyone in the world's got a podcast about it? And they're all intellectuals discussing it. I'm going, how come? I was just listening to Black Sabbath and running around. And how come you didn't say anything then? No one likes it. I told you so. But I'm sitting there going, I'm no genius or intellectual, but excuse me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that what's happened is that, I mean, it's very complicated, but it's just the last 10 years has been the sort of inculcation of people's, you know, narcissism into what, you know, you would call it virtue signaling or whatever, that sort of allows them to take the these sort of drastic moral decisions that they don't realize echo throughout the sort of authoritarian halls of eternity, and the idea that you have to support the people you dislike in their ability to say what they want, because otherwise eventually it'll come for you. And that's one of the things that people who are, you know, the sort of unwitting fools or whatever you want to call it, you know, the useful idiots, as Mao would have said, in this war, in parenthesis, they don't really realize that eventually it comes for them anyway. Like you,
totally.
You're not going to decide, you know, eventually it will come for the comedy you like and the music you like. And, you know, it's we talked about this 20, 25 years ago. I mean, quite a few people could see it coming, could see what was going to come, you know. But
and also what I think is very dangerous is, especially, you know, like primordial lyrics, primordial songs, right? They go back into what? They go back into the collective psyche of the tragedy, but the nation itself. So a group of people, your forebears, that have gone before you, right? So what they went through. So you're still connected psychologically, spiritually to your forebears. And when I see that these young kids have been, you know, let's go and tip statues over and say all this and do that, not only have they turned them into these psychological foot soldiers or useless idiots, but to me, I think that the greater damage is they're giving them a sense of self-loathing, but not only into themselves and their own culture, but they have no respect or gratitude to the spiritual connection, the psychic connection to their forebears who have gone before them. So it's almost like a psycho-spiritual genocide.
Well, okay, let's unpack that. I think I don't think you're wrong. I would use maybe slightly different words, but I think what I would say is that we've taught people to be citizens of nowhere.
Great description.
Instead of citizens of somewhere, and that's
citizens of nowhere. That's a great description.
when you're a citizen of nowhere, you can be pulled up from your roots very easily.
Totally,
you can be taught. You know, that 2 and 2 = 5 or whatever else, you know. A citizen of nowhere is very malleable and easy to control and is easy to rail. I mean, I think most of the culture war stuff is just classic divide and conquer from the, you know, the...
Yeah, totally.
We're arguing about, like, you know, nonsense, but most. Because they've designed it this way to keep people distracted and keep people at each other's throats. But yeah, citizens of nowhere. And so therefore you're taught to hate, as you say, your ancestry, your history, for all its, you know, dark and light, it is what's, you know, standing underneath us. And if you're completely uprooted from that, you become, as I said, and that's what we've talked about this before, but that's kind of what the globalist, and I don't like necessarily using that word phrase generally, but that's what the global ideal is, to make us citizens of nowhere.
Yeah, and like year zero, isn't it? It's a boring communist saying, but like, bang, you cut off the past, and we start today.
Yeah, and that's,
you know, and so a great description. You're a citizen of nowhere now.
Yeah, you know? And when you're a citizen of nowhere, then why would history be important to you? Because why would these things be of any importance, or they don't? Why would you care about the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans? And if you've been taught, as people have done for the last while, that every part of your ancestry is something negative, then why wouldn't you want to burn the entire house down?
Completely.
You know, and I've speak to young people about this kind of stuff before, and I mean, I don't necessarily blame them. I think that's too easy of an age thing to do. But when you look at some of the things they're being taught...
I blame the school teachers who did it to them.
there's lots of different things. Again, I think that I think the world is a chaotic place whereby finding a linear structure or finding nodes of influence or whatever you want to say, people like to, it's our nature to try and find meaning on this rock that's hurtling through space. And sometimes I think that to just give in to the idea that some things are just chaotic. And instead of there being one grand narrative, maybe there's 50 competing narratives which converge and coalesce into, this seems like the most dominant narrative at this moment, and it might swing another way. But I kind of subscribe to that. But at the same time, it is clear to me that many of these converging ideals are pushing this sort of, as you say, this narrative of uprooting people and telling them that they're ancestry or history has no meaning, or that their history is negative, or that, or, you know, which is a really, you know, facile and sort of evil claim, is that your ancestry, you know, and you have inherited guilt. Your ancestry, people you never, who have no connection to you, are responsible for X and Y. Which is, you know, the idea that somebody from your...
That goes right into Christian thinking too, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that's, well, that's...
You've inherited sin through birth.
That's, that's original sin. We're from, I'm from the country that, you know, I mean, if there was an, if there was an original sin Olympics, we'd be, we'd get the gold medal, you know, of guilt. But, you know, we do, we do pretty well in the paedophile Olympics as well, but, you know, we beat Belgium in the final on penalty. On panel. Anyway, cut that out if you want. No. It's a religion, which is orthodoxy, which states that you have inherited original sin. And like, I've had this conversation with people in America, and they've said to me, and I've gone, look, I'm Irish. If you want to play that game, we can go into Irish history. The idea that the whole of the West and all of Europe, whether you're from Belarus, Finland, Portugal, Switzerland, Luxembourg, Serbia, and that everyone has a blanket original sin of history is just patently wrong. It's just historically inaccurate, and it's just, it's a pernicious myth that people... People who are historically illiterate just keep repeating. But I've had conversations with people, and I've gone, you know, we've talked about things, and I said, okay, that's not true, and here's why. And I've looked at them and gone, you're going to say the same thing tomorrow, aren't you? Because you know, doubling down is a virtue. So, but that first creator album, eh?
Feel the endless pain.
Yeah. Right. Bookbreaker is an underrated one, but
yeah.
I mean, look, it's
but it's true, and it's not just about what you said about 5 minutes ago, where there's an amalgamation of different things converging. It's almost, I guess, if I'm correct in that understanding of it, it's like what Thomas Sowell said. You know, Thomas Sowell, that black guy, as he said, you don't get solutions, you get compromises. You need to keep this stable for the time being before it all falls apart in a different way. You know,
no solutions, only compromises. I think.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, say, you, if you take the, you know, there's how many books have been written about why did the First World War start, or the First World War? And there's never one outright answer. I mean, okay, Gabriela Princip, member of the Serbian Black Hand, shot Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo. And that was kind of like the tipping point. But at the same time, in my chaotic theory of the world, Gabriela Princip got two goes at him. He came round the hill and came back down. In what structured world of pyramidal structure of a world does the assassin get two bites of the cherry or two bites of the duke? You know, it's the world is way too chaotic for there to be a particular structure, I think. But yet at the same time, this 17-year-old guy killed him and pushed everything over the edge into the First World War. But is that the moment, or is it one of a preceding points of light, 10,000 moments to that point? I mean, so I like to drag almost every argument into the gray area in the middle, which I understand is really frustrating for people because they want a sexy answer. They want this.
Yeah.
Because of that. Whereas I go, how about we talk about the 100 reasons in the middle that get so frustrating, and we'll just, you know, break your brain, because that's not... People want like just one sentence of an answer. But how did the First World War start is very, very complicated. And that 10,000 historians have failed to fully answer-ish. Of course, it's many different things. So I kind of believe that there's a backstory of something like that to almost everything. So, you know, I'm when you look at young people and the way they relate to phones and technology, and how it's, if you're 18 now, it means you've been from 8 to 18 with a phone in your hand telling you that you know, the as I said, the narcissistic digital impulse of everything you've ever thought is worth something, but also the fact that you're living externally, not internally. Everything you're doing, you're living in a movie version of your life with you as the main character, without with a, let's say, a lack of hubris. Is hubris the right word? Lack of understanding to kind of step outside and go, I'm not the main character. Someone has to stack the shelves. Do you know what I mean? We're living in a strange society where...
Well, it's like when they go to video, when they go to gigs and they film them.
Sure.
And I sit there and they're all standing there like this and they're looking through this thing and they're probably never going to watch it anyway. But I sit there and I think to myself, but you're going to, even if you did watch it, you're going to go home now and watch an experience that you didn't have.
Well, it's, you see, Steve, I would have said to you that 8, 9, 10 years ago, they were filming it for that. Now they're not. Now kids are filming it and they're live streaming it today. I'm here right now. As in, my life is better than yours because you're not here. But yet it's, you're not, of course.
But the point is, the point is, you're not, the band is here.
here's the thing that we don't understand, right? And I've begun to think about it a bit like this, is that music for some young people is, it is the backdrop to their life. It's not the soundtrack to their life.
No, completely.
Backdrop. It's what is happening in the background while they are doing other things. And they are the star. Whereas, so if you in 1987, you were feeling, I don't know, let's say you were particularly feeling a bit isolated, feeling a bit depressed, feeling a bit down. Robert Smith spoke for you. Morrissey spoke for you. James Hetfield, whoever. Now, kids don't have that identification with anybody speaking for them. They or other kids who are the same age as them are speaking for them. Like they say, there's this. I was reading this thing where somebody was saying that the first time ever in history, kids are getting most of their social, cultural, moral, and historical cues from other kids, not from adults. They're listening to kids are telling them, or China.
And now they're bringing kids in to tell adults what to do.
Yeah, well, you see, is like, you know, the Greta Joan of Arc story. I mean, I think that's all about optics, because if you have an agenda that you want to put to the United Nations, what better way to do it than to send a kid, who I feel sorry for, by the way, send a kid in to do an adult's job, because no adult will risk that 30-second bit where they tell a kid off online, because the optics of that are so terrible. It's like a Trojan horse of an argument that's sent in to render all the adults in the room impotent. That's how I see it. And I feel sorry for her, by the way, but because she obviously has some issues. But like,
I probably could, but it's that head on her. I can't get over it. First time I saw her, I thought that the fella that made Lord of the Rings had left a cage open for one of his extras and it had scuttled out and made its way to the UN and bleh.
Yeah. Well, I think
it is a good joke.
I think that she was carefully constructed in order.
Oh, come off completely.
But in that sense, though, like, I mean, like we come back to the music or whatever, like I said, in 1987, 88, who spoke for you when you felt like an outcast? And that was Robert Smith speaks for me. I'm a goth. I'm a Curehead. And that's why I think sometimes when you see young people, they seem so optically uniform because they don't identify with a subculture anymore.
No.
And it seems to be, it's very sad, of course. We grew up in a time when there was goths and Cureheads and punks and straight edge people and garage rock people and psych rock people. And, you know, somebody handed you, as you said, the Susie and the Banshees album and went, listen to this in 1988 or Minor Threat or Black Flag. I think that all of that is just a romantic myth that's about to be buried in our heads. It doesn't exist anymore. And like, it's technology that is the cause of this. So I kind of have quite a reasonable amount of sympathy for young people, but I blame the people above them for not teaching them the principles of free speech or the principles of debate or the principles of, you know, all of these things when you're teaching them like, yeah, this is the best way to get your way. And that is,
which is a great lead in to talking about, although we may have missed a record, but that new record, which seems to me that's very what that the lyrics on this new record are about.
How
which is this lack of rebels.
Yeah.
There's a great line in that Howard End song, you know, is this the death of language? Mm. That's a great line.
Yeah.
Wonderful. And that album seems to be, I mean, it's a dark record. And it's one of the, I think it's one of the easier accessible records compared to the last few.
Maybe.
I mean the other ones are a little they're more musically abstract, whereas I think this one is quite
it's a bit more angry.
It's angry, but it's but somehow it's not as harsh on the ears for me. But see, I read some reviews. How come reviewers always get everything wrong? I read a few reviews where they go a couple said the same thing. Oh, the first half of the album, it's front end loaded and it kind of weans off at the back. But it was towards the back of the album, like halfway through. Then I started to go, man, I'm really getting into this. Right. And then I read all the comments, and there are tons of them were going, these are my favorite songs, and they're all back end. That All Against All song.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. All Against All is a really nasty song.
The nasty. And that middle section where it's like shamanic.
Yeah. Oh, with the throat thing. Yeah.
I loved it. That's when the record really started to sink into me.
I found I could just do that. And I was like, where did this come from? I can just do this. So we started, and then it's in the key of that whole bit in the middle. But yeah, All Against All is, and it's about playing. This is a horrific song. Like in a sense that what it's saying is that every street you've ever walked in every ancient city has ran with blood, and that is the ultimate human nature, and it's playing a character who's mocking faith. He's mocking the New Age. Pagans, he's mocking the religious. He's going, it all will just end like that every time forever, because that's the nature of humankind. And so it's saying all against all forever, there always will be, your streets will run with blood. And because I was in Turkey and I was in some Balkan countries, and I was doing this trip just after lockdown, and every city I went to where I looked up the history was like the siege of something in 1582 and and there's the hanging square and there's the whatever. And you just went, that's just what we do. So I went, I'm going to write the most horrific song, which is just designed to just go, no hope forever. And so that's the.
I don't know what it's saying about me. I was like, oh, I think this is my favorite one. I hadn't read the lyrics yet. And I was like, all right, okay. Now I've got another thing to pile on top of it. All right, now we've got the lyrics.
The lyrics are brutal, but the whole point was that it was to play a character who is mocking. He's mocking. He's going, where is your Ragnarok? Which is like to all the New Age pagans, where's your end of the world? Where's your Millenarian prophecy, or where is it? It's not coming. When even the end, as you preached, it isn't coming. So I mean, how it ends is like, it's a dark record, but it's kind of rebellious spirit to it, which is kind of like, well, we've lost the war, we might as well throw it in and go down fighting. It's not without complete hope, but it's sort of it's kind of addressing I suppose it's asking a question like, who are the rebels left? Where are they?
Yeah. I mean, that first track, how it ends, the opening track.
Yeah.
Those lyrics are fantastic. Great clip. And Killian, a friend of mine, he helped make Eternum clips. He made the clip. I like it. I like the clip.
It's awesome. Yeah. And that the line in which is, how did it feel when they called your name for the last time and all that kind of stuff? And again, I suppose it addresses the idea that people have sort of willingly hand over what have been historically hard-fought freedoms. And I was arguing with a friend of mine. I said, the most important word in any language is liberty. And he said, no, it's love. And I said, what if you love something that's fucking evil? Sorry. And he was like, I suppose. I said, it's liberty. It's the pursuit of every indentured slave, every man and woman throughout history. It's the pursuit of intellectual, moral, physical, geographical liberty. And so the album is kind of revolves around the concept of how do you deal with liberty and that word and what it means. And we're living in an era where we're lurching in towards authoritarianism, and people are willing it into their lives. And so
I know, I can't believe it. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And it's interesting you say liberty, because Jordan Maxwell, he might even say freedom above liberty.
Yeah,
because he used to say the Statue of Liberty is it's not freedom, which is why it's on an island off the mainland, and which is why sailors get liberty from ships, right? Which is you're still under authoritarian rule, but someone's granted you some liberty instead of having actual freedom. You know,
the reason I use liberty is because if you use freedom, It's a bit more analogous, and it brings into account questions of free will. Have some complicated philosophical ideas or issues with and how it relates, which I haven't quite figured out. But liberty seems to be, to me, more defined.
I know what you're saying about trying to get freedom.
It has a historical precedent that should be baked into our political system. Like, you know, liberté, égalité, fraternité, or whatever you want to say, you know, the measure of the French Revolution. And so, which was, of course, theoretically at the start, I mean, this is, the peasant class rebelling against the monarchical system of divine right of inheritance, or whatever you want to say. And so the idea that, are we just too decadent and, you know, suckled at the teat of, obedience, to be able to understand that we're lurching towards an authoritarian society. And like I said, the idea that people who want to consider issues of liberty and freedom are somehow, you know, the state is convinced, or whatever the state, well, I've convinced the enemy. And so, again, it comes back to what we talked about 20 minutes ago, which was the idea that the powers that be, whatever we want to call them, I don't know, the 1%, the political elite class, are just using classic divide and conquer tactics. And so they've hoodwinked people into going, here's, you know, what does that J.P. Mencken says? The average man doesn't want freedom. He wants to be kept safe. And so this is where we are. And so for whatever my small drop in the ocean is, the album is a rebellious album.
Big time.
Which asks the question, you know, is this really what you want? Is this really where we're going? And like I said, if this be the last mountain we have to, you know, climb up creatively or musically, well then, you know, I made my metaphorical last stand, I suppose. So and I think the metal scene needed a rebellious album, at least how I saw it. It needed an album, you know. And so that's what we made, you know.
But that's brilliant! I love it. It's my favorite out of the last few, really.
Yeah.
Which is funny. Yeah, I find it it's so. God, what's the word? See, I love watching people try and review Primordial, describe Primordial albums. They're always going, it's like
Well, I think I've read a few descriptions, which is like, it's like sort of going back in time to be stood on a windswept hillside in like 1850s Ireland with like, you know, the sea, you know, sort of lashing up in your face, realizing, you know, you're at the end of your days. I don't know. I think it's the mix.
I'm at the end of my days. Trouble.
I think it's a great. It's a mixture of like, you know, tragedy and might and I mean all the great things we love about heavy metal, but you know, if people want to get into whatever the album is about, then they can. But it's also, you know yourself, Steve, some songs are not, they're not imbued with huge deep meaning. Like there's one of the songs which I just wanted to get across, I can't remember the name of it, it's somewhere 4 or 5, it's the one with the video for it, and I just wanted to get across the message of, or the idea that people have been setting out in boats for distant shores they didn't know forever. A bit sort of like, not quite a migrant song, but an idea that, you know, X amount of people set out in this boat. And this is the idea of like, here comes a shore of a land you have no concept of or no knowledge of. And you're about to come across another peoples. And just that, you know, an ancient port upon which no feet will ever, something. I can't remember the name, my own lyrics. But I just want it, like, it's just a sight and a feeling. There's no... People have said to me, oh, this is your this is your pro-migrant song. And I said, well, if that's what it means to you, then that's okay. Maybe it is. It's just about the constant nature of movement of people across seas. And the idea that, imagine being on that boat after being at sea for 3 months and arriving at Plymouth Rock or maybe Australia, maybe, you know, or wherever. And, you know, as you say, seeing the indigenous... Well,
You almost get small tastes of that when you first start touring, you know. You're in a van and you go, great, you know, I'm going to go here. I've never been to Switzerland, and get out and sleep in a barn and play metal, and which is the other great thing.
Yeah,
being underground.
Yeah, that's the beauty of That's the beauty of touring. That's the beauty of traveling, the beauty of seeing other cultures and people and countries.
Yeah.
Realized, I mean, I was always obsessed with the idea that you've only got so many spins around the ball of dirt. You've only got, there's all, you know, the law of diminishing return states that even our conversations we've had over the years, there's a moment where they are finite. And so is music being created. So is, you know, I'm kind of like death obsessed in the sense that.
Yeah, well, sorry to laugh there. I'm not laughing at what you're talking about. I'm laughing to go, certain things are finite. I thought, that's my sex life. I've reached that step. Because as I said to my friend one day.
Maybe your sex appeal. Maybe your sex appeal.
Oh, no, I don't even think I've ever had any. But I said to my friend one day, you remember the first time you had sex with a girl? I went, yeah. I go, you do know there will be the last time you have sex with her.
Yeah.
Right? And I said, I think mine is here.
I think it happened 5 years ago. Yeah, no, that's exactly it. I'm sort of obsessed with, like, I know I am totally obsessed with, hey, TikTok, time running out. You better do all these things. You better get to play in Buenos Aires. And you better get to South America. You better get, you know, you need to do these things before the sand in the hourglass runs out. And that's sort of like, that's sort of what just keeps driving me all of the time. Now, other people go, I have plenty of friends who go, they don't even notice the passing of time. They go, oh, yeah, we're 50 now. It's like, yeah, TikTok. I don't know. I just feel like relentlessly driven by the pursuit of constantly trying to just make or do something or. There had to be something happening every 3 or 4 months or I'm just completely and utterly restless, you know, which is why I went, you know, mad in the last 5 years.
I was going to say, which is why during that lockup, you ended up getting into sarcophagus.
That was 1987. But yeah, no, I mean.
Yeah, no, but I mean.
It's more why I almost, you know, ended up like, I lost bits of whatever part of my mind was left to lose, I suppose, you know. Well, I got some of it back.
Yeah. So here's what I wanted to ask you about too, because I love some primordial video clips, and I think my favorite, even though not my favorite song, I have to admit, is that Babel's Tower video clip. Wow.
Yeah.
Now that was made by Gareth Averill. So is that the guy that's connected to your uncle, Steve?
Yeah, that's his son. Yeah,
his son, right.
That's my cousin. He's the guy I made the April Men music with. That video is quite old now. It's like 10 or 12 years ago.
I know, but it's brilliant.
Yeah, well, Babel's Tower was the construction, I mean, in biblical terms, wasn't it? Not the construction of a tower, and didn't God have different nations or peoples working on it who couldn't speak the same language? And it's a song.
Yeah, that's something like that. The conspiracy thing is that EU building is in the shape of Babel's Tower. And
yeah, maybe so.
But without the meaning of the song, the video clip is stunning.
Well, that's when we had, you probably had 4 times the budget you do now to make videos.
I was going
to
say, there's some budget on this one.
Yeah, it's when there was more physical sales, more money, more everything. And so you got 4,000 or 5,000 euro, whatever it was, to make one clip. Whereas now you have to make like 3 for 2.5, or it's, you know, the downsizing of your dreams, Steve.
So where was that filmed? Because it's so well shot. I love it.
It's up in the Wicklow Mountains, just near the Sally Gap. Right. Yeah, no, I mean, the new videos are great as well, but that one has a bit
more
time and space and editing and stuff on it. And then the bit in the middle with the magic mushrooms and, you know, Paul is sort of burying a version of me. And
you and Paul always seem to be in the clips. But you two look like the, you two have very character driven faces. I watch them and I just go, these two could be actors. It's great. Paul's very good too. It's great.
Yeah, he's great. But also Exile Amongst the Ruins, where he gets to shoot me and I'm the English soldier coming back after the First World War to England, to Ireland. I love this video. I think it's a brilliant video.
Yeah, it's a great one too.
As many views as it should have, I thought that song would be a bit of a bigger song. I thought the video was great. And in the video, him and Johnny from Malthusian and Conan and the great Dave from Cleave are, they're like the IRA guys, and they catch me, they execute me. And it's a brilliant video. And yeah, it deserved some more views, to be honest with you. But Making videos, I don't necessarily enjoy the process. I think I'm a bit, my attention span isn't the greatest. But, and because like it's there for people to see, I enjoy it that it's a it's reasonable work of art. But it, and it has to sort of tie in with the music and have some sort of resonance. But I'm not a movie guy. I'm more into the, you know, the touring and the playing live and the recording and stuff. So Paul is very into it. He really
is. Right. Cool.
And he looks like he does, you know.
Yeah, brilliant.
So, he has an epic face. So yeah, it's
totally.
But yeah, it's Babel's Tower. It's just like it's a real simple song. It's just an apology because it's about misunderstanding of language. And so we thought that was going to be a big song from the album, but other songs ended up being bigger. And that's the thing is, you know, when you know what it's like, you're in the middle of making the creative process, in the middle of making a record, and you think, oh, these are the three big songs. And then people who love the record go, oh, why didn't you pick those two? And then 3 months later, 6 months later, you go, oh, yeah, I see that point now. Like there's a song that Nothing New Under the Sun that I see now should have been one of the singles. That's the
I did find the Thousand Fathers, or was the victory is a thousand fathers defeated none or something. I found that one. I did think other songs. Oh, I thought that song could have gone before that one being a.
Yeah, I mean, I Nothing New Under the Sun is the gong 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 with a sort of chunky rhythm guitar that has the big chorus in it. And realistically, everyone who listens to the album goes, "Oh, that's one of, if not my favorite song." You go, okay, maybe we should have made. Maybe. You know, but you're in the process. It's hard to.
Oh yeah.
You know, like you must know when you're trying to write a joke and you're thinking this is going to kill it, and then you do it, and then oh.
I've had jokes where I go, oh, this is going to be great, and then they go out there and you just do them, and then I'm going out there where I've got a great crowd, or I'm in that creative space, and I'm just rabbiting on. I made up that thing about Greta Thunberg and I said on stage out of the blue, right? Like, and then I've written this joke. Oh, this is going to kill, and then no, I'm not impressed with that one. Like, so I thought that one would work, but
yeah.
So what are your plans? And also, Mick left, didn't he?
Yeah, Mick left. Yeah.
Why was that? What a bummer.
I think Mick. Just sort of fell out of love with being in a band, to be honest. He might
Mick is Mick. Sorry for people listening. Mick is the was the other guitarist.
Yeah, he'd been there for like 21-22 years. I mean, I don't want to put words in his mouth. We didn't address it in any press thing because it's not really a primordial way to make big, you know, eulogies or big statements. So we don't really do any statements, but he just sort of quietly stepped aside. He just, when we went around to making the album, he just says, I don't have any songs. We said, look, you know, Storm Before Calm, you're in the band. You don't play on that record either. I said, you can just step out. And I mean, look, if he wants to step back in maybe in a year or two, you know, I don't
think. Yeah, great.
Sitting at the door closed personally, but maybe he does. I don't know. I think that he just got sick of being in airports, being in fields with tons of people, being in a backstage. Sometimes it just runs its course, and
oh, mate, I know it. It can,
if you've run out of energy for people and time, and you it's become a chore, and you're like, oh,
yeah,
airport call and blah, blah blah. You have to still want to be getting on a plane to go to Mexico City, and not be like, you know what, I just want to go home. And so I've never lost every weekend that I'm not somewhere else feels like a weekend wasted for me. I'm like, if I'm sitting at home for 3 weeks, I'm like, I need to be going somewhere. Like, but I think he.
Well, I remember that. That's when he used to go, I'm going to do the merch for this band so I can get on tour and just go out, you know.
Yeah. But like.
And he used to do Marduk and all that.
Yeah. Nile. And I'd worked for lots of bands, Immortal and Destroyer. I think he just kind of fell out of love with it. So.
Yeah, I understand.
In fairness, rather than drag it out, he just went, you know, I'll just step aside. So
for those, and maybe just have a rest, as you said. I think that's what happened to Ventor. He ended up back in Creator. I think he's finally thought, I don't want to do this anymore. Then took about 2 years off and went, no, I think I do.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that for people, some people said, oh, the band looks a bit different live now. And I go, well, look, what are you talking about? I mean, the band's been going 33 years. Of course we look different, you know? And there's nothing you can do to stop the aging process and the Reaper, you know?
Jerry's in there now playing guitar, isn't he?
Best guitar at the moment, and we've another lad called Shawnee who helps us. So if you're longing for that iconic blondie on one side, black haired fella on the other, look, You know what I mean? It's trying.
I don't think you understand primordial.
No, and also you don't. You know, we don't have time machines. We can't stop the aging process. So, it is what it is. You know.
I know, it's funny how you age and you don't really notice it. Then I see pictures of me when I first moved to Ireland, and I go,
"Yeah,
oh my god, I look like a teenager." I'm like,
"It's so funny you said that." I just got a picture of today. Dara sent him. Dara from Invictus, our mutual friend, sent me a picture of, I think it's me, him, our friend Dave, and the guys from Rotting Christ in like 96. And like gaunt little guys with like long hair and like stupid magician beards and stuff. The magician's beard is that stupid like pencil. What is this?
I know. I've got early 80s photos where I actually used to cut the fringe. Yeah. I'm like, what's going on here?
Andy, like, ever even speak to us?
I mean, like the guitarist from Manowar, you know, that second worst hair on earth.
Yeah, just out of pity. Steve Hughes and bangs. I can't see it.
All right. Well, this has been excellent. Do I have anything else I want to ask you? We've had a good time. We've got up to how it ends. Are you going to do another record, do you think?
Say again?
Because some people are speculating that how it ends is basically, is this our primordial bow out? But
that's why I did it, just to give people something to talk about. No, I don't think the end is the end.
No, neither do I.
Certainly, I am conscious that we're in the last few chapters. It's been 30-odd years, 32 years, 10 albums, 33 and a third. Certainly, there's a moment where you get to where you must have done the same thing, where you realize like, oh, the main body of your career is now in the rearview mirror. And that's an unusual thing to realize. And maybe at 42, 43, you didn't realize it, but now creeping up on 50, it's becoming more evident. Like, hey, TikTok, you're in the last couple of years of this. So I'm very thankful and gracious of like, oh, brilliant. We're going to, you know, I still love traveling and going and playing gigs, and I still feel brilliant. And, you know, you look at the lads and we're like, look at the thing we've created for whatever it's, you know, the thing we've created. And you're standing on stage in Sao Paulo or, you know, wherever you are. So I still find that beautiful. But there'll be a day will come where you go, I think this might be the last one. So I don't think this is the last album, but I called it How It Ends to kind of maybe cryptically insert some jeopardy into the record. Is it the end of the band?
Some journalistic controversy in the metal world.
Which doesn't care anyway. So
All right. This has been excellent. I think that we've been about an hour and a half.
Wow. If you got through to the end of this, brilliant. Thank you very much.
I've hope you'd enjoyed this. I've enjoyed it, Al. It's been great. And I'm coming over there probably about June.
Yeah, yeah. What? We'll be here.
So you make sure you got the sarcophago on. And that's a position I see me, folks, when I go out there.
Yeah. Insulter. Awesome.
All right, buddy. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed this, folks. And thanks again, Al. I'll see you soon. No worries.